1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Can you hear me? Yes or no?
How many people are here today for the first day, for the first time? Okay, thank you all for coming. Yesterday, identifying some themes that were important to them based on the presentation in the morning by three women who are living with AIDS. In the afternoon, the work groups worked toward developing position statements that they felt that we could all ought to support as a network. And today's task is to take those position statements and to prioritize them if that wasn't done in terms of what the groups think is the most immediate need, and then to talk about ways in which tasks that might come from supporting those positions that individuals and organizations can assume some responsibility for. Some kinds of tasks and responsibilities and timelines in which they need to occur. The facilitators met this morning, and we've sort of compared notes. We actually debriefed yesterday and met this morning, so that further instructions will really occur in your small groups, particularly to where your group was when it broke yesterday. The important pieces today, we're also going to talk about self-help groups as a way of each of us being able to leave here and go back and doing what we need to do for ourselves and building a base of support for ourselves in terms of the long-term involvement that we expect to develop into. Some of the positions that I've seen are very broad, long-term, you know, organizational development ideas, and they're fine. And people are in different places, and those of us who come from organizations where we can begin to move on those have a lot that we can take back and say that, you know, I met with a group of black women, and this is what, you know, we believe and we think. Okay, some of us are very isolated and in different places, and we need to find in our immediate locations other people who are willing to be with us and to support us as we take on this work. I think that we heard yesterday from people who were on the front line, so to speak, in many ways, about the frustration, the potential for burnout, the really high risk activities, not sexual activities, but high risk organizational activities that people are carrying every day as a result of trying to bring some level of change to the organizations in which they work. And it would be hard to go back into those places without, or to ask someone to come into those places with us without understanding that there's a way, a process, a means by which we can begin to take on new challenges and, you know, collectively work for change. And we see that as the self-help group development. So we're going to talk more about that today also. Do you have any other questions? Are we ready? It could be a statement. We have a little time, apparently, here.
Okay. Linnell, she was on the panel yesterday.
Yes.
She explained that the AIDS virus will readily transfer when a woman has yeast infection just prior to a period afterwards. And I can't seem to find Linnell or Angela explanation to that.
Linnell is here.
Hi, Linnell.
Hi.
New York City Department of Health.
I think I hear kind of a lot of that. There are mediums that are better for, like, if you were doing a biology lab and you wanted something to grow, you create a medium. So when you have a yeast infection or any kind of infection, it's like you have an open wound, then that's an entry place for something to get in. So when your balance is off, and I guess when you get your menstruation, our body goes through a lot of hormonal changes. So the mediums are changing. Our acid, alkaline balances are changing. So that makes you more receptive. That's the why of it. And also with certain foods. So that's why if you deal with certain food things, you're changing your acid, alkaline balances, and you're less receptive. That's why in terms of your intestinal tract, we get fissions on them. And so we're more receptive to certain kinds of things. So that's the kind of start to give you the background information about what that is. And that's why you can do certain things when they talk about like cottage cheese or yogurt. That's if you get something live, you're talking about a live culture to start to balance out the imbalances that are going on. That's what's behind it.
Thank you, Coletta. Hold on.
Discovered an incredible number of just wonderful sisters, and the person that I have the opportunity to introduce right now is one of those sisters. we met and we just sort of seemed to click. And again, I feel enriched by having met her. She also works with Sisters with AIDS. She's been very, very supportive of Cheryl and Missy in that house. And she is one of the people that's helping Missy fulfill her life dream. Missy's life dream is to have an apartment of her own, to be her own woman, and to have her own house. And she's been supportive in that process. Kalevia Carter is currently a volunteer coordinator for the DC Department of Corrections. She's a community activist and has been in the forefront of many of the human rights issues, especially those human rights issues as it relates to AIDS. Kalevia? Appreciate the sister's comment, because I think it is really important to make sure that we feel like we're all coming from the same place and have a basic understanding of the facts. I also agree that there's obviously no perfect order. And one of the things, as an epidemiologist, we do a lot of counting of numbers, looking at statistics. And one of the things that I always try to keep in mind, as somebody that I once worked with said, is the faces behind those numbers. And so I think that although, you know, you can talk about which way would be best to present information, I think that having had the experience that you all have, and I'm sorry to have missed yesterday's, but to get a sense for the people who are affected by this, because a lot of us don't know people with AIDS yet. A lot of us are just starting in that work, and, you know, even myself, who plays with the numbers and does research with it, I have much less contact with the actual people. And I think sometimes it's really important to keep in mind the faces behind the numbers. And so I'm going to present some numbers and some facts and figures, but with that in mind, making sure that we're remembering who we're talking about and thinking about the kinds of things that we want to keep in mind for Black women. I'm going to need somebody to just turn the power on, and then, yeah.
We decided, since we're running behind time, is to, for each person in Uncle Helene has to go, we decided after each presentation to have a 5 or 10 minute answer, and then afterwards, after everyone's presented, you have more questions, you can do it that way. But so while she's here, you can ask a question.
Yeah, I've kind of tried to alter my schedule a little bit. I've got a zillion agendas while I'm here in Washington today, but I'm going to try to stay to as much to the end of the session as possible, but I'll take some questions right afterwards. Okay, if you can turn on all the way on, it has to, yeah, okay, and then you'll be my slide coordinator there, okay. First of all, and I don't know, is this pretty clear to people, or do you need to have lights down? First of all, just so that we're all talking about the same disease, this is the definition, the CDC definition. And basically, the CDC definition is the definition, case definition that's used for surveillance of AIDS cases. Most of the data that I'm going to present comes from our surveillance system. It's a system where the state health departments report all the cases that they find to the CDC. So it's funneled up from the states, and that's where we get our information about AIDS cases. So this definition here is AIDS is a debilitating or life-threatening illness caused by the human immunodeficiency virus characterized by HIV encephalopathy, which is dementia, HIV wasting syndrome,
characterized primarily by severe weight loss and diarrhea, and certain other diseases that are due to immunodeficiency in a person with laboratory evidence of HIV infection or certain other causes of immunodeficiency, so that we have a disease that are, where our immune system, as everyone knows, is not working correctly, and therefore we're susceptible to diseases that we would not ordinarily be susceptible to. Next slide. Keeping in mind that AIDS is what we're all talking about, but when we talk about AIDS, what we're really talking about is HIV infection. And I think that more and more people are trying to focus on HIV infection and not just AIDS and AIDS cases. Because when you talk about AIDS, what you're talking about is the tip of the iceberg. So that you have at the top here, the small number of cases that are reported to CDC and the small number of cases that we talk about. But underneath is really the larger problem and where the larger numbers are. And that's when you talk about the non-specific signs of signs and symptoms of HIV infection, and even the asymptomatic infections, which is really where the bulk of HIV infection is, moving on up to eventually AIDS. Next slide, please. Looking at AIDS by age and gender, just to point out, and some of these numbers, as I go through the slides, some of the numbers will change, but the trends won't change. Obviously, we're getting cases reported daily, so you can never keep up totally with the numbers, but the trends stay the same. For females, obviously, there are far fewer cases of AIDS than in males, and there are also some other differences. For women, the peak incidence of AIDS is shifted slightly, so that most the highest incidence or the highest occurrence of AIDS is in women in the age group from 25 to 35, with 30 being the highest peak. So we're talking about a disease that's affecting young women. Keep in mind also, when I talk about AIDS cases, that the incubation period between HIV infection and then development of actual symptoms and development of AIDS can be anywhere from about 5 to 10 years. So when we're talking about a peak incidence or peak occurrence of AIDS in women 30 years old, we're talking about people who were probably infected in their early 20s. Next. I'm sorry, okay. All right. Am I standing in front of them? All right, we'll make the necessary adjustments. My voice is pretty loud anyway. So. It's a little harder for me to see them, huh?
It may work on the screen, on the wall.
I think that's going to be too dark on the wall.
Can you hold that?
Hi, please.
Blacks and Hispanics make up 39% of the total AIDS cases, 70% of all the female AIDS cases, 71% of all the heterosexual cases, and 77% of all the pediatric cases. All four of them, but particularly the last three, are things that have obvious implications for black women. Next slide, please. If we look at all AIDS cases again, just briefly, a comparison which many of you may already know, but when we look at the proportion of cases that are black in the population, about 27% of cases compared to the black population in the United States, about 11.5-12%. Clearly, although blacks are not in the majority of AIDS cases, compared to our population in this country, we're far overrepresented in the number of AIDS cases. Next slide. Now, if you look at that comparison for women, you find even a more disproportionate representation. We have about 56% of all female, 54% of all female cases are in black women,
And we make up 11% of the whole population. So clearly, when you look at females, there's even a greater sense of the disproportionality of black females. Next slide, please. Comparing the transmission categories for women by race. For white women, 41% of all cases are due to intravenous drug use. For black women, that's almost 60%. If you look at the next category, sex partners of IV drug users, another 17% of all cases in black women are due to sex with an intravenous drug user. So that about 75% of all the cases in black women are due to intravenous drug use. And the other category, the next largest category, 14% in black women, sex with men who have other risk, and that's primarily men who are bisexual. Next slide, please. This looks at all females, but again, given the proportion of female cases that are black, I think this has real implications for us as black women. This looks at the percent of increase by the different transmission categories for women comparing last year to this year. In the IV drug user category, there's been a 177% increase over last year. The next largest increase is a category called undetermined. And what that is for most, in most cases, is the fact that somebody died before you were able to investigate, or somebody was not able to get a very complete description of what the exposure might have been. And in most cases, when people have gone back and done as thorough investigation as possible, a lot of that is actually heterosexual transmission. So that probably that increase of 119% reflects an increase in heterosexually transmitted cases in women. Next slide, please. This just, I wanted to show this because this refers to that 14% that I talked about in black women that was due to sex with a man with the other risk factor and primarily bisexual. If you compare white, black, and Hispanic, of men who report either bisexual or homosexual exposure as their risk factor, in white men, 86% of that is due to men who are gay and exclusively homosexual, where 14% is due to men who are bisexual. But in black men, that's double, 30.5% of men who report either bisexuality or homosexuality report being bisexual. So that clearly, the risk for women being exposed to a man who is bisexual is much greater for a black woman than white female counterpart. Next slide, please. Okay, I talked about HIV infection and that being the real issue. And so I'm going to show a couple, some of the data that we have on HIV infection. AIDS is a reportable disease, so that AIDS reporting is much more complete. HIV infection is not reportable universally. There's a few states now that do report HIV infection, but we don't have numbers to the same degree to look at kind of a universal picture. There have been some studies and some surveys that have looked at HIV infection in selected populations. The military, as of October 85, started screening all recruits. Anyone who wants to join the military automatically gets screened. Now, you can disagree or not with that policy. However, the data exists, and I think it shows some important, it has some important implications. If you look at blacks versus whites, black men have about a 5 times as great a rate of HIV positivity, antibody positivity, compared to white males. And black females, that's about 3 to 5% increase over white females. So again, when you're looking at not only AIDS cases, but also HIV infection,
that same trend is seen. Next slide, please. This is a study that was done in New York State, and some of you may be aware of some of the filter paper screening that's going on. Let me just explain that for a minute. What's being done in a lot of states to try to get an idea of the rate of infection in women across states or across cities is to look at the rate of HIV infection in their children, in their newborn children. Newborns will reflect the maternal state. If a mother is positive, if a mother is antibody positive, if a mother has HIV infection, she's going to transmit the antibodies, not necessarily the infection, but she'll pass the antibodies to her child during pregnancy. So that if you test a child, a newborn, and you find antibody, that's really reflective of the mother's antibody state, not necessarily the child's antibody state. So one of the things that somebody came up with is that to get an idea of how many women are infected in certain in areas, since most children have PKU screening for metabolic diseases when they're first born, you can also use that same blood and look at their antibody status as a way of looking at whether or not women are infected. All of that to say, in this study that was done in New York City, looking at antibody seroprevalence in newborn children, a rate of 1.6, almost 2%, was found in women in New York City, in the babies, and therefore reflective of women in New York City. And that varied from borough to borough, with places like Manhattan and the Bronx having much higher rates than places like Staten Island and Queens. And if you see the rest of New York State, New York City is obviously much higher. When that was looked at by race, the rate for black women was 2 to 3 times higher than that of white women. So again, when we look at the antibody status in indicative of HIV infection and not only AIDS cases, again, we see the same trends. Next slide, please. Just want to flip for a moment to pediatric cases, because I don't think you can talk about women without talking about the children. If we look at the two main categories of pediatric cases, those who got their infection perinatally, in other words, those whose infection was transmitted from their mother versus those who had an infection transmitted by blood or blood products. Those are the two main ways in which children get infection. If you look at those who got their infection from their mother, 62% of those cases are in black children. If you look at those who got their infection through blood or blood products, only 23% of those are black. So again, focusing on the woman, you see that the risk for a black child as a result of infection in black women is much, much higher for black women and their children. Next slide, please, which is probably the last. Okay, if we look at the characteristics of the mothers whose children acquired HIV infection from the mother, again, the IV drug use issue pops up pretty clearly. 57% of those children had mothers who were intravenous drug users, 19% had mothers who were sexual partners of intravenous drug users. So again, about a 75% of all of those children had mothers who were intravenous drug users, and about 80% of those children, 75% of those mothers were black. Next slide. Okay. Just a few points, and I'm going to wrap it up because I want to take questions and see if people have any thoughts about any of this that I've presented. And I presented it fairly rapidly, partly because of time, but also the numbers themselves I don't think are as important as getting a sense for what we're talking about. I think it's pretty clear that what we're talking about in in women is heterosexual transmission, and particularly connected to heterosexual transmission and intravenous drug use. Intravenous drug use, even when you look at the heterosexually transmitted cases, still pops out as the main factor. A thought about that, though, although a lot of people will say, well, I'm not an intravenous drug user, and my partner may not be an intravenous drug user, but I think that what we found with the AIDS epidemic is that intravenous drug use is the bridge that has really brought the AIDS epidemic out of the gay and bisexual male group and into other segments of our population. So although today in women across the board, and particularly in black women, intravenous drug use directly or one step removed from a sex partner is the main route, I think that we're going to find increasingly that more and more people will be at risk because our communities are not separate. It's not easy to make that distinction a lot of times. Intravenous drug use and drug use in general is crossing over more and more. One of the things that people are talking about is the fact that crack houses today are becoming what the bathhouses were for gay men 10 years ago. Sex for drugs is becoming a way of life for many people. So when we talk about intravenous drug use, we need to expand that and think about drug use in general and think about some of the things that we need to do with our in our communities in general. When we talk about AIDS in black women, I think, which is what the Black Women's Health Project has always been about anyway, is empowerment for women. We have to think about what are the ways that we can protect not only ourselves, but protect our sisters and also our children. So that we're talking about issues of empowerment if we're going to make any difference in the AIDS epidemic in black women. I'm just going to stop there and take any questions that people have. And, okay.
Yeah, going back to your slide on the clinical spectrum for
right.
HIV infection, is it true that, because we've been hearing in New York that the nomenclature has changed for ARV as opposed to PGL? So could you just clarify that to me?
Could you say what ARV is?
ARC used to be, you know, AIDS is an evolving disease. You know, we're only 8 years into the epidemic. And so one of the things that I think when you think about AIDS and HIV infection, you've got to keep flexible. This is definitely not a static situation. It's a dynamic and always changing situation. And as we learn more about AIDS and HIV infection, there are bound to be more changes that come along. When we first started talking about AIDS, that was back before we even knew what the virus was, how it was caused, and all that. And so a lot of the kind of the preliminary terminology had to do with lack of knowledge and understanding of the disease process. And at a point, people thought that there was a state ARC, which is the AIDS-related complex, and all the other symptoms related to AIDS. HIV infection, but not quite AIDS, not quite to the point where you're getting diseases like the pneumocystis pneumonia or Kaposi's sarcoma, some of the diseases that are indicator diseases for AIDS. People thought that there was this ARC state where you got so far and probably didn't go much farther. I think now most people feel that if you have HIV infection, it's approaching 100% of people who get HIV infection will eventually develop AIDS. And so thinking about in-between categories is probably not as useful as just thinking about HIV infection, HIV-related disease, and then the end of that spectrum being AIDS.
So is there a difference between ARC and the PGL?
PGL, which is the generalized lymphadenopathy, where you have enlarged lymph nodes. Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, basically, those terms are more or less not useful. The generalized lymphadenopathy is something that is probably an early stage of HIV infection. And then ARC was thought to be more more non-specific symptoms like the wasting syndromes and things that are now considered part of AIDS. So that distinction between lymphadenopathy, ARC, and AIDS is becoming much more blurred. And again, most people are just thinking about HIV-related diseases. Forget stages is what I'm saying. Is that staging is not useful. You have HIV infection, you're going to get AIDS. And therefore, all of the rest of this in-between sort of thing probably is not real useful. Clinicians still stage. You know, clinicians still will talk about this level of HIV infection, that level of HIV infection. But in general, you know, it's probably not a real useful thing to think about, well, he has ARC versus AIDS, because it's all a spectrum of the same disease, and trying to subcategorize it like that is probably not real useful in terms of trying to conceptualize what's going on there.
Does that make sense? It's politically useful because the only people that qualify for financial benefits are people who have CDC-defined AIDS. People who are very, very sick and in fact die from ARC do not qualify for benefits, and people who are very, very sick and possibly could die just even at the preliminary stages of HIV infection do not qualify for money.
Although that's changing, and that's changing pretty quickly. Yeah, that's changing pretty quickly, and I think that staying away from hard and fast categories is going to help that, because I think that as people recognize the fact that you can't separate out ARC from HIV, you've got to say if somebody is HIV positive and symptomatic, then they should be given all of the rights and benefits. And it, you know, to say that they're HIV positive but they're not quite ARC, we'll forget them. You know, I think has been has not been useful.
I agree.
Yes. Yeah, it's a real difficult issue. I think that there are some situations where blinded testing, when it's truly done blinded, makes sense and is reasonable. And by blinded, it's not even an issue of getting the results back to people, because you can't. If it's done really blinded, then you're not testing an individual, you're testing a population. I think it's been helpful in trying to define where the problems are and where resources need to be allocated. I think it's also helpful, staying on that, in that, yeah, it's kind of a vicious cycle. If you don't know that there's a problem, you don't get resources to do something about it, unfortunately. I mean, in the best of all worlds, we should be able to wave a magic wand and say, well, we know that this problem exists. Let's just, you know, everyone needs money. Realistically, that's not going to work. And so sometimes proving that you have a problem helps generate funds. It also brings attention to particular populations that might not have realized they had a problem. And then you can institute testing where people get individual results back and all that. I think that it has to be blinded testing, I think, only works when people are sticking to the strictest of ethical and scientific principles, so that issues of confidentiality are not ever breached, that it's really blinded and no names or anything that could ever identify somebody is really kept that way. And only as a first stage to say, okay, we know where this is where the problem is, or as a way of doing kind of unbiased continual sampling so that you know how the problem is changing. If you put an intervention in an area and you want to be able to see whether or not that intervention is having an effect, doing that. I also think it should only be done at somewhere where you can also offer people the ability to get tests and get their results back. So that it should be done jointly, so that somebody couldn't say, well, I found out that I was in a blinded study, but it was at the same time that there was no AIDS testing available to me. I don't think that's right. And that, in general, the CDC has been fairly firm about that blinded testing should only go on in places where people also have the ability to get their test results in other ways. Okay, have to cut it. Thank you.
right along. That iceberg theory always kind of worries me because it reminds me of the fact that, you know, in some terms, the black community is a lot like the Titanic, and we're headed straight for that iceberg. Many we have many of which we have in the black community, not just dealing with AIDS, but if it's not AIDS, as the old timer told me, it's something else. It's always something else in our community, but, and they say they don't serve ice water in hell. But we're going to start with our, somebody got that. we're going to start, but in that context, though, there are things we can do. We can start building coalitions, and we can start taking our organizations within our own community and start doing something about that. Gertrude Hunter with the National Council on Negro Women. I'm going to introduce you. She's a physician trained as a pediatrician, an administrator, and educator, former national director of health for Project Head Start, the regional administrator for the U.S. Public Health Services, and former professor and chair of the Department of Community Health and Family Practice at Howard University, and also is a member of many national committees and advisory boards. Ms. Hunter.
Someone once told me that when you get in your 60s, it's time for reflection and quiet. And I blindly went into that era, approached that era, thinking that it would be a time of peace and quiet and reflection. And I can honestly say that this is the greatest period of rage that I've ever experienced in my life. Before I describe why I'm in rage, first greetings from Dorothy Height, who is the president of the National Council of Negro Women, and also greetings from D.R. Warwick, who, in her rage and recognition of the neglect of black people having raised $1.5 million for AIDS and given it to Elizabeth Taylor to give to AMFI, found out not only would they not report on the money, but not 1 cent went to any black group. And so for that reason, she founded the Warwick Foundation. Now, let me describe how I got to this rage. I was a professor at Howard University. And by being in community health and public health, I always had access to this kind of information. And it was evident a long time ago that black folks had trouble with AIDS. And that black women particularly had trouble with AIDS. And I went around talking to different people, and I know a lot of people. I've been around a lot, and you see the majority of the committee that I know a lot of people. And the only person who would listen to me when I said we've got a terrible problem was Dorothy Ike. And she said that she would use whatever influence she could to see that we would get something going. And we talked and talked, we couldn't get any money. Now, I don't know how much you know about the National Council of Negro Women. So the National Council of Negro Women is an organization of 235 sections, community-based sections, and it has 32 affiliates of national organizations, all the major church women, the sororities, the labor unions. This organization has a potential outreach to 4 million women and their families, because women are in families. Okay? Might not like the way the family, especially, but they're in families. Just like people who have addiction problems, they're in families. And women who are pregnant are part of that. They might be part of that, but in families. And so with this strong emphasis on families, it seemed to be the perfect vehicle to begin to address the problem of AIDS in black women. So she and I went to New York and we met with some people about getting funding for the National Council of Negro Women to mobilize its constituency at the community level. And someone said that they'd give us $20,000 for planning money to have a conference. So Dorothy Height and I organized this program with a lot of volunteers, very outstanding women and some men, design a program to present at the 43rd Annual Convention. of the National Council of Negro Women. These are women who come from all around the country and all around the world. And we were supposed to have the $20,000 underwrite the cost of this convention for the AIDS workshop, the 3-hour workshop. And the morning of the workshop, someone goes up to Dorothy Heights and tells her that I'm, or something about me, that I'm either outspoken or not respectful enough, and they weren't going to give them the money. Yeah. And so here we were having a convention with people who were supposed to be reimbursed for travel and for materials and things like that. And they said they weren't going to give us any money. Well, I also had another friend who had access to the press who was going to go and tell them about what they did. So they called back and said it was $10,000. So if anyone thinks the National Council of Negro Women is operating this program on a lot of money, they're not. We do have some indebtedness over the Office of Minority Health. I'd ask you